Thank you to Rula for sponsoring this episode.
What Came Next is intended for mature audiences only. Episodes discuss topics that can be triggering, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, animal abuse, suicide, and murder. I am not a therapist, nor am I a doctor. If you're in need of support, please visit somethingwaswrong.com/resources for a list of nonprofit organizations that can help. Opinions expressed by my guests on the show are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of myself or Broken Cycle Media. Resources and source material are linked in the episode notes. Thank you so much for listening.
Mary Kane is an author, athlete, and nonprofit board member that was once hailed as one of the greatest young running talents in the world. But behind her success was a much more complicated story involving the pressures of elite competition, her experience inside the Nike Oregon Project, and the challenges she faced as she tried to find her voice. In the years that followed and through civil legal accountability, Mary transformed from an athlete into an author and advocate, examining the culture of sports and the treatment of young athletes. In this episode, Mary reflects on her journey, the highs and lows of her running career, and all that came next in this new chapter beyond the track. The Broken Cycle Media team is extremely grateful for Mary's advocacy, energy, and willingness to share with our community today.
My name is Mary Kane. I'm the author of the memoir, This Is Not About Running, which details my experience as a young athlete navigating the traumatic culture that we normalize in sports today. But I'm much more than just my past as an athlete. I'm also currently a medical student. I'm really curious about things, which is why I like balancing athletics, school, relationships, and all things writing, reading, and all of those sorts of fun, creative outlets. I grew up in a town called Bronxville. I'm one of four girls. I'm number two. And I think having somebody who was always two steps ahead of me because she was a couple years older did always inspire me. I think it was really cool to be able to follow in her footsteps with certain things. And then having two younger sisters toddling after you, I think makes you develop some form of leadership skills. And I think that was super important towards my long-term development. Most significantly, growing up in a household where every single one of us was seen as an athlete. Every single one of us can go off to the Olympics and dream big about being an athlete in our own right.
Absolutely. As you develop your sense of self in your younger years, how and why were you drawn to running?
I was really good at it really young. Growing up, I was a competitive swimmer, and the sports are pretty similar in that there's a team component through relays, but it's primarily an individual sport. I think I had such a beautiful team experience as a child with swimming. We were really competitive. We were really pushed, but it was so fun. And even though it was an individual sport, people could find their own niche, whether it was butterfly or breaststroker, their distances. And it just felt like despite being competitors, there was still such a camaraderie and friendship to it. I kind of went into it being like, I hope this is like my swimming experience. I went to Bronxville High School, K-12. So I was there for 13 years. By the time I tried out for the high school track team as a seventh grader, I had gotten to a point where like the gym class mile, I was pretty fast. As a seventh grader, I was on the varsity team and I qualified for our state championship meet. I was the youngest person in the race, and I went to nationals that year. That was met with discomfort within my program and within the parent experience pretty early. People who were seniors were disappointed that I was beating them, and their parents would say things to my parents. I was also on the varsity swim team. And I wasn't the fastest girl on the team, but I was probably like the fifth fastest. As a result, everyone was like, oh my God, thank God we get more points. Instead of it being this, you're taking something from me by being good mentality. So I think from pretty early on, there was this odd dichotomy for me where I really loved running. I loved training. I loved the competition. And I loved physically how it felt. But it was pretty quickly obvious that it wasn't going to be quite the same experience that I did in swimming. By the time I hit freshman year, pretty quickly, I went from very good to great. It was suddenly like, I am not qualifying for the state meet, but I'm in contention to win the state meet. And my times were getting to that point where it was like faster than almost any freshman girl had ever run. Suddenly, I'm starting to challenge all time lists. That became deeply problematic when it started to be channeled at me in really toxic ways, like parents yelling at me at meets and parents calling my parents and saying just like really weird and inappropriate things about what I should and shouldn't be allowed to do as an athlete. This toxicity ended up spilling onto the track where a lot of my high school teammates started directing that anger at me, yelling at me and talking about me behind my back, both in school and on the track, and doing a lot of things that made me feel so isolated, but also kind of scared. I think their behavior really did normalize toxic behavior for me. Like my inner gut knew it was really wrong and really scary. But as a kid, it was really just my parents being like, nobody should ever be talking to you like this. This is crazy. I reached a point where during my sophomore year of high school, and by the end of my cross-country season, I was on track to continue to be one of the best girls in the country. But I privately was experiencing almost this breaking point within my public school. I ultimately left the girls' team, joined the boys' program, and I detail a little bit more about what went into that process in the book. By the end of my sophomore year, I was now the national record holder. I leapfrogged that much more beyond what I was able to accomplish my freshman year of high school. Now I was able to like qualify for Olympic trials and get into professional races. My name was known nationally because of that. So by the time I was starting my junior year of high school, I was being forced to rejoin the girls' team. I made the pseudo decision to leave the cross country team. So I was going to email a bunch of college coaches and be like, hey, I'm going to swim for the next couple of years. I am going to maybe run for fun, but remember me in a couple of years because I'm the national record holder and I'd still love to run in college. And the week that I was doing that, in the most serendipitous way, Alberto Salazar called my house because he's like, I think you could be America's next great athlete. Alberto himself had previously been a Nike athlete. It's why he had a building named after him at Nike World Headquarters. He won the New York City Marathon, the Boston Marathon, had gone to the Olympics. He had like a close relationship with a lot of folks at Nike. The Nike Oregon Project was the greatest professional distance running program in the world. And Alberto was the head coach of the program. Essentially, the goal of the Oregon Project was to develop athletes who could suddenly take the U.S., which for quite a while had been not particularly competitive in a medal perspective at the Olympics, at world championships, at major marathons, and create medalists. This was a professional running program. You sign a contract with a brand. In this case, anyone who's a part of the Nike Oregon Project had to be a Nike athlete. And then you move out to Portland and you train with the program. So it was a Nike sponsored program. Alberto was the head coach. And it was the best runners in the world. And then me, who actually became one of the best runners in the world while a part of the program, but at least initially it was like, and this 16-year-old girl. It was incredible. For people who don't follow track, picture in your mind like the most famed person at the top calling you. That's exactly what this experience was. And I think being in the midst, I just felt like nobody wanted me. It just was suddenly like somebody sees me for what I want to be seen as. So having this person call me and be like, no, you actually do matter. And who was not only this huge figure in the sport, but also a new adult to trust. There's almost no words to describe how much that meant to me. An athlete has since come forward named Kara Goucher, who's also written a memoir. She had been a previous athlete of his who he sexually abused while she was a part of the program. And he talked about her nonstop and was like, you could be the next Kara. He sent me her old gloves within a few days of us ever speaking to each other over the phone. When I opened up that package at 16, I was like, oh my gosh, Kara is amazing. This is so cool. I can be a future Kara. And now I look back at that and I'm like, that meant something very different for him. And I did not understand that at the time. It's so interesting to have the perspective of me at 16 and what that first meeting looked like, and me now as a 30-year-old woman who has years of experience under her.
Thank you again to Rula for sponsoring this episode. With each What Came Next interview and new survivor I meet, the same thing becomes resoundingly clearer with each conversation. And that's the importance of talk therapy. Not only is it my number one tool and resource I lean on when things are hardest in life, it's great for those in-between times when I'm just figuring things out too. But the biggest hurdle for me is finding the right therapist who takes my insurance. That's where most online therapy platforms fall short. But Rula does things differently. They partner with over 100 insurance plans, making the average copay just $15 per session. That's real therapy from licensed professionals at a price that actually makes sense. And Rula isn't just affordable. The experience is tailored around you. Other online therapy platforms might match you with the first available provider, whether or not they're a good fit. Rula considers your goals, preferences, and background to provide you a curated list of licensed in-network therapists who are actually aligned with what you need. Because they know that finding the right therapist can make all the difference. No wait lists, no frustrating back and forth. Rula makes it easy to find a mental health provider who's accepting new patients, and appointments are available as soon as tomorrow. Go to rula.com/WCN to get started today. Thousands of people are already using Rula to get affordable, high-quality therapy that's actually covered by insurance. Visit rula.com/WCN to get started. That's rula.com/WCN. You deserve mental health care that works with you, not against your budget.
As soon as this relationship started, there are things now I can look back in retrospect and be like, oh my God, that is so scary. But at the time I was like, this is the coolest thing ever. For example, from the get-go, he was so attentive and so charming, saying literally all of the right things. I see your long-term potential. This is a long-term relationship. I want to build this incredible experience. And pretty early on in the relationship, we did disclose a lot of what was happening with me at Bronxville because I wanted to explain why I didn't want to run for my high school anymore. He definitely was behaving kind of in that savior role. I was immediately like, you want to develop me long term? You want me to work with somebody who I thought was a mental health provider? Those sound like green flags if I've ever heard of any. And I was like, yes, I would like to be part of this program. Now today I can look back and be like, a lot of that was just not true. The whole idea of making it long term and gradual and supporting a young girl's body were just not real. The only thing that I early on said no to was he did want me to move out to Portland. I'm from New York and I lived in New York. He was out in Oregon at the Nike headquarters, essentially. And I didn't want to do that. The idea of moving somewhere else just seemed like a big early step in this coaching relationship. And so that was the first time we ever said no to Alberto. And he handled it well at the time. He's like, I get it. I'm a parent. That kind of whole initial interaction made me be like, yes, this is a no-brainer. Of course, I'm going to work with him. So early on, it was this long-distance coaching relationship where we texted all the time. We emailed, we called. I spoke to him a few times a day. And I started taking trips where it was like, I'd maybe go out to Portland for a long weekend, or if there was a meet or event, we would meet there and spend time there together. So despite living across the country from him, I had all of these touch points pretty quickly. That year, my performances just skyrocketed. Full disclosure, there are sprinters who are such baddies, and there are field event athletes who are crushing it. But in my event specifically, I suddenly was going from the best high schooler to now I'm actually one of the best women, period. And I'm actually not a woman, I'm a girl. So that transition feels kind of gradual based on the ways that my times were dropping. But it just skyrocketed me to be able to be in all these different types of competitions. Over the summer, in between junior and senior year, I spent pretty much the whole summer with them. I wasn't necessarily just in Portland. I was like in Europe with the team. I was with Alberto a couple times a month. There were probably like two different trips a month where I would see him. One of them was in Portland and one of them was at a meet. But we saw each other a lot for it being a cross-country coaching relationship. What's really interesting is at 30, I can look back and see the relationship was really problematic from the get-go. During this time, it felt to me really positive. There were a lot of really scary and really dark moments that happened during that first year or two where I was on top of the world and in the program long distance that are really upsetting to look back on. But I think I just suppressed them, shoved them down, and would always excuse any bad behavior. Because any of the negativity that I was feeling was not from my coaches, was not from my teammates. It was from competitors. It was from the media. I'm competing against all these adult women. They were just deeply unfriendly and unsupportive to me. I was kind of like, okay, I get it. I'm like 17 and beating you. So I was kind of like, grow up, ironically, to the adults once again. So I was at this major turning point when I moved out to Portland my freshman year of college, where the only people who have ever made me feel wanted are the Oregon Project. I think it's important when you talk about stories of abuse to often highlight why someone can get trapped in an experience. And so it's really important to highlight how unkind other coaches, other athletes were, because it kind of shows you that as a 17, 18-year-old girl, if you're really almost only able to like sit with your team and you don't feel safe going and talking to anyone else, you're going to get into this experience where you kind of have nowhere else to turn. You don't see normal, healthy coaching experiences. All of a sudden, there's this shift where there was all of a sudden this negativity about the way I looked and my body. So when I moved out there full time and all of a sudden things became almost publicly toxic. It's not just these private moments that start to turn scary. I'm being yelled at in front of teammates. I'm being shamed for the way that I look and being told I've clearly gained weight. You're not even trying in workouts. And very quickly, my mental health just started to unravel, probably mostly because I was starving myself. And it's hard to be like your mental and emotional sharpest when you're starving and training at a crazy high level. There was such a gradual build where it wasn't all of a sudden this sharp 180 from the get-go. There was inappropriateness, there was weirdness, there was discomfort. But it grew in a way that I didn't see it growing. And then by the time you're in it, you're not thinking, oh my God, this is really inappropriate. You're thinking, wow, I'm disappointing the only person who wants me here. I'm disappointing the only person who supports me being a part of sport. And I think this control that Alberto had over me by being both the savior for me in sport, but also, and obviously I don't mean this literally, but I thought this at the time, this like safe space because nobody else wanted me. So I was really deeply isolated, and I became even more isolated because my touch point, the people who cared for me and always supported me, aka my family. Once I moved out there, Alberto instigated the classic tactics of initially grooming my parents to be like reaching out to them and keeping them posted, to all of a sudden completely icing them out and punishing me whenever I reached out to my parents upset about something, and if they called him, I would get punished. So I started to distance myself from my family too. I don't know if I've ever said this before in an interview, but I think one of the things that probably in retrospect really helped me is I actually was in college. I continued taking college classes. I was a matriculated student at the University of Portland. Over the course of my freshman year of college, I completely mentally deteriorated because I was constantly reminded that I was heavy, even though for full context, I wasn't actually heavier really by almost any standard than I'd ever been before. I just always share that because weight is not how we succeed in sport. Like, you succeed in sport based on your performances on the track. And by literally all accounts ever, I was succeeding on the track once I started to be told that I was fat and that's why I was slow. So the mental dissonance was pretty extreme. And I was like, quote unquote, good kid. So if you tell me to get better, I'm going to lose weight. I'm going to do it. And I threw myself into it. It was just never enough. I was constantly berated. And the mental health issues that I started to develop included pretty constant suicidal ideation, severe body dysmorphia. I really started to develop this really toxic imagery that my body looked differently than it did. The outlet that I developed was cutting myself and other forms of self-harm, like hitting myself and kind of other actions that were deeply unhealthy. All the while I was working with this quote-unquote sports psychologist. He's somebody who I now know was not actually a psychologist. As a result, there was no confidentiality between anything I was ever telling him. I was working with the assistant coach's wife, who I knew wasn't a nutritionist, but I still thought she knew about nutrition. I trusted her and was open with her about my struggles. I'm on Nike's campus this whole time. As an adult, I can look back and be like, I was fully starving myself, being berated every single day, severely depressed and suicidal. And I finished 8th at the US Championships. I wasn't going through this experience thinking my team was wrong. I was going through this experience thinking I was a failure. The media was incredibly negative towards a successful young girl. There was this horribly toxic discourse. As a result, it almost made me feel there was more truth to what my team and my coaches were telling me, because other people were parroting the same information and they didn't even know me and they weren't even connected with me. I was just like, all of the things that they said, where I'm going to burn out and explode and get boobs and die, is coming to fruition. I wasn't what they wanted from girlhood. I just really was not liked by the media. And that cascade of further isolating me resulted in my freshman year of college. I had 2 very close attempts at suicide. I was starting to get really scared of myself. I both like wanted to die, but I also didn't. In my head, I was like, this is bad. I have a family and I have sisters and I don't want to do that to them. And it just felt like something was really wrong with me. But again, I was internalizing this all as a me problem. I ultimately expressed very loosely to my parents that I was having problems with food. And they were like, you need to come home. They could see from afar that I had massively changed personality-wise. Like, I went from cracking jokes and being silly to not making eye contact with people, keeping my head down, saying all sorts of cryptic things whenever I did see them or talk to them. That just made them very scared. My sophomore year of college, I moved back home to New York. At first, I thought it would just be like a summer away where I would magically lose the weight and be whole again and it would all be fine. That didn't happen. I spent the next year still a part of this weird long distance coaching experience with the team before leaving at the end of my sophomore year of college in 2016. And it was because I shared a couple more concerning things with my parents, essentially, that made them like, I think you really need to take a step back. They sort of made me leave the team. I think often people are waiting for that hero moment or the happy ending or she spit in his face and you get to cheer. And the really, really sad truth is that my experience was so painfully drawn out, so not empowered. It was kind of this, my parents really think I need help. I don't want them to be mad. My journey to realize what happened started around the time the New York Times piece came out. 3 years after I leave this program, it was 2019, Alberto got banned for 4 years for drug violations. I read the whole piece. That was the first time that I was like, whoa, was he doing something bad? Was this me or was this him? I think within a week of it coming out, I sent essentially like a draft of an op-ed to Lindsay Krauss, who is the editor of the New York Times. And then as soon as I sent her the piece, she was like, hey, can you come into the New York Times offices like now? So I went in and we had this whole deeper conversation, ultimately culminating in us creating the op-doc video and written piece. Even though I came out 6 weeks later with this big New York Times opinion piece where millions of people had watched it, I wasn't all healed. Like, yep, now I know all the things. There were so many revelations that came out in the years after of things that kept and keep making me need to take a step back and look at things differently. It's really interesting because I'm both very proud of that piece and very glad that it's had the impact that it's had on people. But I would never recommend someone do that. My therapist at the time definitely was not thrilled that that was how I managed things. Always give yourself the time and the grace to heal on your own schedule. And from the get-go, I am not the only athlete who came out and has said problematic things that happened while my time on the Oregon Project. There are other athletes who came before me who've similarly stood up and spoken out. After the New York Times piece came out, Nike came out with all sorts of comments publicly where they were like, we never got our complaint, but we're going to do an investigation. The woman in the Nike C-suite accidentally replied all on an email that she was probably reading going through this investigation instead of forwarded it. It was this email I sent to Alberto and my agent. And I was essentially talking about the fact that like I had a really messed up relationship with food, but I still wanted to work with him. And I was just very lost and very confused. And it was like a really upsetting email to reread. She wrote something in this attempted forward, almost kind of being like, wow, she really did have a problem, but it's crazy. She still wanted to work with him. Just this short email. So I'm reading this going, wow, that's crazy. Within however many minutes, hours, I then all of a sudden start getting emails from Nike corporate being like, you were never supposed to get that email, telling me I needed to delete it. And I did what I always advise people to do, which is start off with Google. I Googled all of the legal claims that they were citing for why I needed to delete the emails, and none of them applied to me. And I don't have a legal degree, but that was my interpretation. And I reached out to some people to get connected with lawyers, and it kind of opened up the door for me to have relationships with people in the legal world. And as they dug more into my experience, they were like, there are claims here. I think if you stand up sometimes to the big guys, the odds that they continue to do this potentially lessen, or at least the more you raise awareness of it. And I knew it was going to be really traumatic and really horrible and make me hate everything. But I just felt like I was in this position where I deep down knew I was going to be okay. I knew I could weather that no matter how hard it was. And I just kind of knew somebody else out there maybe couldn't because of the phase that they were in life or where they were in their trauma journey. Like, it's not on survivors to save the world, but I still felt like I was in a place where maybe I can create some change doing this. What I always said to my attorneys, I felt like I won the day I sued, because it was me, like, I'm going to get emotional, which is so interesting, but it was kind of me standing up for myself and me standing up for others and being like, this isn't okay. This sort of behavior cannot continue. You are actually harming people. Anything else that happened was never going to be as satisfying as that first day. Just saying stop and saying you can't do this to other people. Throughout the whole experience, I was just like, nothing else can really top that, because I don't think any time you go through any legal experience that's deeply traumatic and built off of trauma, there's no way to get back what you lost. There's no way to ever rewrite the past. The best you can do is hope to make it better for the next person by standing up for yourself and prevent this stuff. And I feel like that happened the day that I sued. The lawsuit has since ended, and I did not sign any form of NDAs about being able to speak about my experience. And that was something that was incredibly important to me, because I had already spent the last few years doing public-facing advocacy work to prevent the abuse of others. And the idea of signing any sort of rights away, that meant that I couldn't talk about a lot of stuff that I'd already previously spoken about publicly, just felt very silly. So that's part of the reason that I was able to engage in civil action, but now can speak about the experience. My memoir is titled This Is Not About Running, and it's available anywhere books are sold. This story is really about my experience as a young girl navigating the abusive system that is sport. The reason that I titled it This Is Not About Running is, despite it taking place during my experience as an elite and professional athlete in the sport of track and field, the actual messaging is something that's unfortunately and tragically much more universal than a sports story. You don't have to be a runner to walk with me through my journey of really being abused as a young person and seeing the ways in which there are systems failures, from the ways that parents treat kids, schools treat kids, and corporations treat kids. I think that's something that so many different industries struggle with, and I hope can be an outlet for parents and kids as they navigate whatever they dream big to one day do, so they can see more of the problematic ways in which people exploit young people. When I sat down and for the first time opened up the physical copy of it and actually read it from start to finish, I just felt such pride and such calm. I felt really at peace. And I think that was something that was the only thing that I really personally wanted from the experience, because the reason I wrote the book was less for me, because why would you ever put yourself through that experience for fun? But I wrote it more because I felt like there were still things that I was seeing in the years after my own experience that troubled me. And even the way people would interpret my New York Times piece, even though it might be like a quasi-positive response, I still felt people were like really missing the broader problems. For example, people would be like, oh, that coach was really bad, glad he's banned. And I'm like, that's not a bad way of thinking, but that's not what solves the actual issue. The problem is a broader cultural and systems problem, not just one coach. Because if you fire that coach and you replace him with the same type of person, there's no change. We're just constantly moving around people. There's this full culture of perpetuating toxicity and abuse. And I think when I sat down and got to read it without an editor's hat on, but instead as a reader, I was like, okay, this is a book that I think could have really helped me as a kid. So I think the writing process was really difficult, but cathartic in its own way. In the last few years, most of the advocacy work that I've done has been with organizations like the Athlete Survivors Assist, or what we call shorthand the Assist, which is working to end sexual abuse in sport for all athletes. I think being able to serve as a board member and help lend my voice into this really important but often not spoken about conversation has been something that's been honestly really healing for me as someone who's navigated these systems, because it's really beautiful to see other people who really care and who are fighting for change. But also, I think a lot of the work that we've done is truly game-changing and impactful, whether it's helping to support organizations to create safer systems or creating platforms such as Compassionate Coach, which are educational opportunities for people to create safer sports environments. I personally find a lot of fulfillment in altruism post-trauma. And although it's not something every survivor has to do, I think having that outlet through the assist has been really meaningful for me. People can find me on Instagram. My handle is at @runmarykane. I'm not super active and I don't often respond to DMs, more for the busyness of medical school and kind of the mental health boundaries I put up on social media. But I still really appreciate it when people do send messages, and I often do still read them, even if I don't quite have the emotional capacity to always respond.
Thank you so much for everything that you do, for your advocacy, for your time and your energy today. Thank you for joining our community.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on and for also lifting up a lot of people who I care about, like folks a part of the Athlete Survivor Assist who are doing really awesome work preventing sexual abuse in sport. So I appreciate all that you do as well.
In 2019, Alberto Salazar faced allegations from the United States Anti-Doping Agency. The allegations purported that he had violated anti-doping rules while leading the Nike Oregon project. Salazar denied intentionally doping athletes. According to a 2019 ProPublica article, a quote, arbitration panel decided that Salazar had committed three anti-doping rule violations. He participated in the administration of a prohibited method, he attempted to tamper with the doping control process, and he trafficked in testosterone, which is a banned substance, end quote. The arbitration panel upheld a four-year ban for Salazar from organized athletics.
On September 30th, 2019, the Nike Oregon project was shut down less than a month later, on October 10th of the same year.
In 2021, Alberto Salazar was investigated by the U.S. Center for Safe Sport and received a lifetime ban, separate from the 2019 ban he had received. The ban that remains in effect today was implemented because of findings of emotional and sexual misconduct.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Next week on What Came Next.
2016 to 2018, it was a weekend occurrence where he would get really, really upset and violent. Prior to all of this, he would only get violent on special occasions, holidays, weddings, things like that. He always ruined those days, but that was just expected. And it might be something little that triggered him, but it always was something.
Thank you again to Rula for sponsoring this episode. Don't forget, thousands of people are already using Rula to get affordable, high-quality therapy that's actually covered by insurance. Visit rula.com/WCN to get started. That's rula.com/WCN. You deserve mental health care that works with you, not against your budget.
What Came Next is a Broken Cycle Media production co-produced by Amy B. Chesler and Tiffany Reese. If you'd like to help support What Came Next, you can leave us a positive review, support our sponsors, or follow Broken Cycle Media on Instagram @BrokenCycleMedia. Check out the episode notes for sources, resources, and to follow our guests. Thank you again for listening.